Professor Hart, Jennifer Hart, on November the 6th, 1980. Seven. Number seven. Got to get the basic data right. 1989. Met Isaiah,
right,
in 1928.
In 1928, yes. He's 2 years younger than I am, and he came up to Oxford 2 years before me. He was at a Corpus. I was at New College, and I think I first met him at the Undergraduates Philosophical Society, which was called the Jesuit Society, and certainly I first had any conversation of any length with him there. I may have met him in the street before being introduced, but that's where I first, and we became friends quite rapidly.
Can you tell me just a little bit about yourself? What I need to know about your own biographical
yes.
background before you go? What kind of person you were when you came up to Oxford?
In
sociological terms.
Yes, right. My both parents are Jewish, and we were brought up, I and my two brothers and sister, fairly orthodox, but in the north of England, in Harrogate, in Yorkshire, where my father had until, he migrated from London in 1900 when he married, and first started a business, a furrier's business in Bradford, and then my mother couldn't stand Bradford, so they moved to Harrogate, and there he started a business which became a very successful ladies' tailor, ladies' dresses and furs, and it was very successful for a time. He went to Paris every year and bought models and took me with him once, and that was that. The house, they became fairly prosperous after a time, and he had a passion for building houses, which he built in this way. Mm-hmm. There were practically no other Jews there at all, and so I was brought up very largely in a non-Jewish society. My father...
But you said it was an Orthodox?
Yes.
And what did that mean?
That meant largely no bacon. I mean largely no... the dietary things, but there was no synagogue. It was such luck, I hated it all. There was no synagogue, so it was on the high days of Day of Atonement,
yeah,
and New Year, we went to Bradford and took rooms in the hotel. Went to synagogue and fasted. And I didn't fast until I was 13, Bar Mitzvah. I won't turn this into an anecdote about me, but anyhow, that's probably all you will want to
know. Were you inclined to philosophy when you came up? Tell me a little bit about your education,
yes.
So I know.
Well, I was, after 3 years, unhappy time at a Jewish house at an English public school named Cheltenham, which was absolutely, I lived every moment. I was just about to run away. My father said his business was going down, he had to take me away, and sent me to the splendid grammar school in Bradford, where I adored, which I adored. I was a classical scholar, and I got a scholarship at New College. One of my brothers has been at St. John's, he's also been at Bradford Grammar School, and I was a classical scholar, and interested in ancient history, and vaguely interested. I knew no philosophy, but I got interested in ideas of that sort.
I thought you'd already read Spengler.
No, not till I was at school. Mm-hmm. I then met, yes, you're quite right. We had a very strange intellectual master he was an intellectual, he wasn't actually a first-class scholar, and he was mad on Spengler, and he introduced me, and I became wildly excited by it. And
what was it that excited you?
Oh, the whole huge cosmic sense of history.
The sweep.
Yes, the sweep. And I followed it, more or less whole. I actually wrote, while still at school, an article in the 19th century laughter on Spengler. And I ceased to believe as soon as I began do philosophy in Oxford. But I was carried along by this, and he was an excellent teacher, very unlike ordinary school teaching.
Right. This is roughly the kind of person you are, and I can already see that there are certain analogies between your background and Isaiah's in some sense.
Yes. Though my parents were my father was a very English sort of person. Mm-hmm. Though both my parents were born in England, and I have one.
Your grandparents came over, didn't they?
Not all. Mm-hmm. Three of my grandparents came over. One of my grandparents had been here. The family had been here since the late 18th century.
Right. So that's different.
Yes. Oh, yes. And
but it's,
I had passion for the country. Not Isaiah's thing at all. I couldn't bear to live anywhere else but England, though I love travelling. And so in that way it was rather different.
But what kinship, when you met him at the Jowett Society, you quickly became
ideas.
Friends, what, it was ideas?
Ideas, yes. And also the enormous entertainment of his conversation. Because he seemed to me to have been born middle-aged, and he was like a person who already established in the sort of way. And great gaiety, intellectual gaiety. And,
did you feel, sort of, when you say he was middle-aged, did you feel sort of callow and young in his company? Or did you feel...
He never put one down in any way. No, I felt that there were depths there that I was capable of plumbing.
Did he strike you as a European figure? I mean, someone... From a very different non-English milieu.
Yes, there was a sense of Europe as compared to my rather English background. I adore, the countryside, and I'm very happy with a lot of friends from the grammar school and so on.
Yeah. What books was he talking about? Can you remember what kind of ideas and books
he would talk about?
He
would, if I raised it, he would talk about Spengler if I wanted him to, but he really, really talked about Marx, and of course I got interested. I knew nothing about it.
He's talking about Marx in 28-29?
Well, he would talk about the sweep of history and historians, and...
I more doubt that. Marx in
28-29,
but I don't know. I wasn't there.
No, perhaps that's wrong.
Well, yes. I'm asking.
I have the sense somehow, perhaps I'm just reading it back, that I should try and understand Marx through him.
Yes.
I certainly got that from him at a certain stage.
You meet as undergraduates. What kind of physical impression does he make on you? I mean, what does
he look like? He looked very much as he does now, I think.
And what does that mean?
Well, he was plump. He was much plumper than he is now. Was fat at one time.
The spectacled?
Yes, he wore spectacles, as I do.
Was he already sort of baldish?
I think he had a fairly... I can't really remember, but I think he had a fair crop of hair. Mm-hmm. Yes.
How would he dress?
He always seemed to me to be unlike me, and dressed me badly. But he seemed to always be wearing a suit, which is fairly rare amongst undergraduates at Oxford. That notion of him in Oxford bags is not really a real one.
Or a tweed coat.
Did his and your Jewishness emerge very early as a point of commonality?
No, we didn't talk about it much. He, except I expressed astonishment. I reacted against the whole religion about the age of 12, and ceased to believe, and went unwilling to synagogue with my parents, no doubt crudely said and thought it was all nonsense. And I hated the... My father brought over the from Bradford, teach us Hebrew on Sunday afternoons in our own house. We had to spend beautiful Sunday afternoons learning Hebrew to read, which I never absorbed at all. No, we didn't discuss. He let me feel that he valued the history and the connection with the past. And he, of course, he knew an enormous amount about it. I mean, the amount he knew, if we tapped any question about it, it seemed to me fantastic.
He seemed, in other words, very close to his Jewish past.
Well, he never let me think he believed at all, but he went to synagogue.
Do you think he was, in some sense, closer to the religious doctrines than you were? Did you detect any difference between your attitude to Jewishness and his attitude?
Oh, well, I mean, I wouldn't go in fast and so on and all that, and he did. When one teased him about this, he said, no, I don't believe, but I like the sense of continuity of the past. This is a tremendous thing, which he kept. And I say, you're carrying it a bit far, aren't you? And he would say, I remember once, a bit later, when we were in Switzerland together, he said, what does being a Jew mean to you? And I said, well, I like my Jewish friends, and I think I'm pretty marvellous what they've achieved and done, but I have absolutely no feeling that I want to, be further in. He said, oh no, but the extent to which you're Jewish is to some extent a function of what other people think about you, and you can't get rid of that. So it doesn't rest with you how Jewish you are. Mm-hmm. I remember him saying that at Caen.
Yes, it's a perceptive thing to say as well. Mm-hmm. What do you have any more general remarks to make about what it was like to be a young Jewish man in Oxford in 1929?
Yes.
What did it feel like?
Yes. In my case, it was absolutely no difficulty or unpleasantness at all. I only have one.
Of course, most people don't recognize he was Jewish.
Well, I mean, it's freely said.
And your name wasn't, I know, but I mean, it is a bit different from some people.
Yes, but there was no unpleasantness at all. You would think that if they didn't think I was Jew, they might have dropped anti-Semitic remarks in my presence. But I have only one, over the 4 years, 1926-30, that I was here. I only had one incident, and that was an extraordinary one when I got great friends with a curious South African boy, who was a son of a rather well-known headmaster in Cape Town, who came to New College at the same time. We became quite friends. And in those days, as an undergraduate, you could lunch in your own room and ask for it. And I gave a lunch party and asked him. And in the course of the conversation, he talked about this. Being friends with, as he called them, Kaffirs, South Africa, blacks. And I said, why do you have any feelings about this? But I was very naive. And he said, I don't like it, but I'd rather sit down to lunch with a Kaffir than with a Jew. So I said, well, you are sitting down to lunch with a Jew. And he was so embarrassed. We more or less left the party, and that was the end.
Yeah.
That was the only anti-Semitic remark made in my presence that I heard in the whole 4 years.
But anti-Semitic remark or not, would it also be possible to feel at Oxford in 28-29 that you were still in some sense apart?
Yes. Let's say I saw that I didn't have... Well, of course, I never went to chapel and all that. Um,
And these places were very, in a sense, the chapel was still very much the centre of colleges.
Well, I do.
Men's colleges, not women's.
Mm. Yes.
Point
when
noted.
When I come to Somerville.
Yes. The chaplain was quite friendly to me. I once called him. He was also, in some sense, the bursar. But he never, it was never anything unpleasant. I can't conjure up feeling about any more than I did at my grammar school, where I actually know a lot of Jews.
Well, of course, a lot of the undergraduates were presumably certainly agnostic, if not atheist, weren't they?
Certainly. Well,
so, I mean, in that sense, you weren't different.
Yes, that's true.
They weren't all keen Anglicans.
No. In fact, there was a society, OICU, which was Oxford something, what was it called?
Christian Union.
Sort of non-conformist. And he called on me once. He didn't know that I was a Jew, and said, I felt how awful all that is, but I didn't have any reaction.
Yes.
I think we ought to go across, if only it gets off the crowded. Sorry, I don't...
Resuming after lunch with Professor and Mrs. Hart. We're really still talking about early undergraduate days, 28, 29. I'm wondering whether you can recall political conversations with Isaiah from the very early period as undergraduates.
No. Didn't have any, I think, really. I was some sort of liberal. I remember debating societies at school and so on. I used to be a liberal candidate.
You weren't terribly interested in politics?
No,
really?
I wasn't. No. Mm-hmm.
And he wasn't interested in politics?
Not at that phase. Mm-hmm. No. So we talked about philosophy quite a lot.
When you say that, I mean, specific technical questions in philosophy?
Well, philosophy was done then, it wasn't all that technical.
Yeah.
And rather large-scale questions about Aristotle and Plato came up. And so. I can't recall the detail of any philosophical conversations.
Yeah. Switching, I want to widen the circle. Who else are you aware of as being his friends in this very early period, 28, 29, 30, before you leave, go down from Oxford?
28 to 30.
Yes.
I knew, he knew Spender, I think, who was more or less contemporary. Came up between me and Isaiah.
Morris not around then?
Yes, I wasn't in Morris Barrow's circle at all.
No.
But I don't think he'd got on to Isaiah, certainly as that. Goes blank.
David Cecil?
Not then, later. He was at Corpus. There was a man called Dickey there, who was a lawyer.
Last name Dickey.
Yes, D-O-C-K-E-Y-E. And one of my contemporaries at school was there, who he knew, but he wasn't great friends with him.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't really have rather stranger people whom he knew through his family were brought into my Ken, two guys out of that period. It's a man called Rachmalevich.
Yes.
I think I met him then, I liked him enormously.
Yes. What kind of impression did he make on you, Rachmalevich?
Brilliant, chattery, and great charm.
Mm. That must mean you have connections with Isaiah in London, or you would see him in London as well as at Oxford?
I think he brought him down to Oxford when
Oh, really?
Yes, I think so. When I moved to London, I did see Isaiah Bissing in London.
But that wasn't until the 30.
Right. I went down in 30.
Yes. I want to return to the political question. 29-30 is
hunger marches.
Hunger marches, the crash, all that stuff. I mean, are you saying this passes by the window but very far away? Is that what you're saying?
Rather, yes. In my third year, I went to earn some money by tutoring son of a wealthy Wykamist. College said he needs tutoring on vacation, would you like to do it? And I stayed at this rather grand country house near Kersoff, near Radlett. And there, the whole talk was about going off to the gold standard and how the socialists are a terrible menace and so on. But I felt the sympathy. And then, of course, before I left, just as I left school, there was a general strike.
Yeah.
And I didn't feel any inclination to join the strike breaking.
The hunger marches went till 32, 33?
No,
yes.
29.
No,
No, I think my question implied only that there had been a stock market crash in the beginnings of the Depression.
Yes.
I don't think I implied hunger marches. Yeah. I think the Jarrow March actually is quite late. It's 36.
Yes.
But be that as it may. I wanted to flesh out a little more what you did with Isaiah. I mean, apart from talking, did you go to concerts?
No.
Did you share music at all?
I knew he had a gramophone with an enormous horn, simply fantastic. Do you remember?
Yes, indeed. He gave it to us at one point.
And I used to listen to records in his room.
Yes.
But I don't think I ever went to his room in Corpus. I don't think I went to it when he was an undergraduate.
Mm.
I don't think I ever. No, I didn't. I'm sure I didn't.
So you would meet in...
When he was elected to All Souls,
mm-hmm.
in 31, I think.
Yeah.
And I saw him there quite a lot, because I had a lot... my Wykamist contemporaries at New College included Douglas Jones, one of my closest friends, and he got to All Souls, and Sparrow had been my contemporary too. So I knew a lot of people who were at All Souls.
Mm-hmm.
I was unsuccessful myself. And and I had another friend called Ian Bowen, who's dead now. And I used to see Isaiah there quite a bit.
Let me back you up just to round out something else. I wanted to get a sense of what your philosophical training consisted in as an undergraduate.
Yes. Well, we had a very remarkable teacher of philosophy at New College called H.W.B. Joseph. Hot water bottle Joseph. He's half Jewish, but his father converted early and became a canon of Rochester Cathedral, on all bases. And he was a tremendous, not bullying, but severe teacher, tremendous sense of the strict meaning of words, all that later linguist people deny, one word, one meaning. And but I enjoyed him. I found him stimulating, and I worked away. And he was a very good teacher of that sort, and frankly conscientious.
Mm-hmm.
He taught Jennifer's father at one period, way back.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a fellow of New College, and Isaiah, when he became a lecturer at New College, he hated Joseph. He thought it was death. It's this narrow, restricted view of philosophy, dead literalism, and so on.
Yeah.
I found it really cursory or stimulating.
Mm.
Well, that was my training.
Stimulating because it was precise.
Well, yeah, it was precise, and he wrote a book on Aristotelian logic, which I still think is a very good book, and I got wildly excited by that. He opened up sort of things I never conceived of in a very clear fashion. He was incredibly clear, though it was rather rigid, the whole thing. Well, that was my training, really, largely.
Yes.
And then there was another, the man who subsequently became warden of New College, called Smith. He was just the opposite. He was relaxed and easygoing and rather vague. Mm-hmm. And the two together were a very good mix.
Would it be possible to suggest that you have a fundamentally different intellectual temperament to Isaiah's?
That your
interest in precision and that kind of clarity and that kind of precise meaning of words is rather different than Isaiah's
much more
expansive.
Oh, and much more. Yes, certainly, it's a much wider and deeper vision, certainly.
Well, that's not necessarily what I was implying. I was implying the comparison was favourable to you.
I see. Well, no, Isaiah was never loose in language, exactly. But he would say things that huge generalisations would come out, which appeared not always to be warranted. I think you feel that more than I do.
Did you twit him about that? I mean,
yes, a bit. Certainly.
Even then,
I queried it. Yes, I think so.
Yeah. Did you ever feel in awe of Isaiah as a young man?
No. He was too. I mean, one felt the radiation of generosity and goodness. I mean, the thing about Isaiah, I've always thought, is that he's as good as he is clever, which is rare.
I remember Elliot Felkin saying this. There was a great friend of ours called Elliot Felkin, and we said, you must meet this fantastic man, Isaiah Berlin, so clever. And when he met him, he said, but you didn't tell me how benevolent he was.
Yes.
It's a very rare combination
to
have someone who's so clever and yet benevolent.
No, I can't recall in detail of what we talked about, really, trade. A lot of jokes on his part.
Yes.
Yes, tremendous.
Do any of those come down to you now?
I don't think so.
Well, the least characteristic remark game is now been recorded for all posterity.
I see. That was our invention.
Yes, that's your invention. The family
game.
Yeah.
No. I met Isaiah in some very peculiar settings sometimes. We often met at a cafe in Soho with other people, friends of Isaiah's. I can't recall their name. Had dinner together when he was at before the war at All Souls, went back to Oxford. I was a barrister. Perhaps the most uncharacteristic setting for Isaiah, I don't know if this is worth saying, I don't know if you've ever heard, there's a chalet in Mont Blanc which was on which for 100 years now has been used for reading parties for Oxford undergraduates. It's above Saint-Gervais-les-Bains. Do you know Savoy?
No, I don't.
And it's underneath the Mont Blanc Massif.
Yes.
And this was built, set up by Michael Urquhart, who was a Victorian figure, upper-class Catholic, who one had an idea of uniting the papacy and the caliphate. And he used to have come to him high up on the Alps for summer sessions, priests from the Catholic Church and mullahs from the Mohammedan. Anyhow, his son inherited this, became a fellow of Balliol, and then used it for reading parties.
In the vac or in the...
In the summer, yes. And it continued, and the wonderful records of the young Macmillan playing some kind of ball game against the wall of the chalet. And in 1933, I went there, and with some a younger fellow who'd taken the management of it on, and there were about 15 of us, and we knew that Isaiah had been travelling in Ruthenia, and I had an address, and so we sent a telegram inviting him to come, and and he did come, and I was sent down. I knew him better than anybody else there, to meet him at Saint-Gervais-les-Bains, which was down below. And then there was a walk up, quite a stiff walk up. And so we went and had dinner at the hotel. And I explained the walk up, and you're expecting me to do that, he said. He said, I'll do it if we can stop at every corner. So about 10 o'clock at night, there were about 3,000 feet to go. We started on this journey, and he insisted on stopping at every turn of the road, and he went on talking the whole time. The consequence was that though I was in splendid training, I'd been in the Alps for some time, I was actually dead when I arrived. He was as fresh as a bee. For all his dislike of the country, he was able to stand it for about 3 days.
But he manages not to notice the country, doesn't he? Mm-hmm.
Yes, that's true.
That's also a story about his quite extraordinary vitality.
Oh, it is. It is extraordinary. Yes. Yes.
Now, you go down. I never know whether you go up or down to London. You go up to London. You go down to London. You train as a barrister.
Barrister. I was called to the bar in 1913. Beginning of 1932.
And you see him occasionally? In Soho cafes?
Well, he would suggest meeting, or most often I would come up to Oxford at the weekend to stay with one or two friends, and sometimes with him.
Yes. Now, he's elected a fellow, you are not. Was that very galling at the time to you?
I didn't mind Isaiah being elected and said to me, no. No, I thought that was absolutely right. No, I wasn't galled. I was rather sad. I rather wanted it, but I soon came not to want it. I very early got quite a large practice at the bar, which I wouldn't have done if I'd stayed sort of sold for a bit. I would have delayed all that. Yeah. So I was in a way quite pleased. No, it didn't rankle at all. I was just rather, because I'd been told by my tutors that I would get it and so on, believe. Yeah. No, I wasn't. No, I was.
I'm asking this question out of order, really, but perhaps I'm asking a question now about your undergraduate period together. In the constellation of your friendships,
yes,
would he be among your very closest friends, or in some?
Well, in a way,
distance?
I felt tremendously that one could be tremendously intimate. I felt, but I saw much more often, because of the way in which your college concentrates you partly, of witness, like Douglas Jay, much more, and other
people. So you saw them more, but you felt nonetheless that if the occasion arose, you could be very...
Well, the whole Jewish side was open to me. It wouldn't have been comprehensible to them. So.
Yeah.
And he was very interesting. I mean, I could ask him questions. He'd interpret one's background. One of my grandfathers was, I forget the English word for it, head of the London Orthodox community.
Yes.
My paternal grandfather, great-grandfather, was head of the London Orthodox community. And excommunicated the liberals.
Oh, really?
Yes. And so he could interpret all that for me and so on.
Yeah. Interesting. Did you still saw him when you were in your practice in the 30s, but would it be true to say that you...
Intermittently. Yes. Not regularly.
You were less intimate in that period through the
30s. Well, intermittent, what I was saying.
Yes.
Yes. It was very easy to feel intimate with Isaiah and pick it up again immediately once met.
Yeah.
Singular. It's a great warmth.
When did you two meet? Is this in this period?
He never remembers.
1936. Right?
Yes.
Where and when?
In Cornwall, at home. I don't know if you know the Institute, Oxford Institution of the Reading Party.
No, I don't.
It wasn't a reading party.
No, wait a moment. I'll tell you. The chalet, which I've mentioned, was a site of reading parties,
yes,
where you got together a lot of young men, then almost older young men, and then you walked in, worked in the morning and walked in the afternoon.
Yes.
It was such reading parties were held in Cornwall, and then Douglas Jay, I think, got together the idea of assembling some of his friends, like
including this, women,
including women, and and I met her then in Cornwall.
And what were you doing? Were you an undergraduate at that point?
No, 1936. I was between being an undergraduate and going into civil service. I had a year. I was too young to do the civil service exam, so I had a year when I was still living in Oxford, because my parents lived here,
yeah,
and studying various things,
yeah,
and preparing to do the exam.
Yeah. And you're already politically active at that point?
Oh, yes.
Yes.
From when?
Well, I was always interested in politics, because my father was very interested in politics.
George Kennedy from Oxford.
And when he stood as a candidate for Oxford in 1910, before my time, but even in the 1920s, I think I was very interested in politics. Because we lived in Paris, and he was on the Reparations Commission, and he was interested not only in international politics, but also still in home politics. He was still quite a keen liberal, mm-hmm, and I was very devoted to my father and took over all his ideas, mm-hmm, not totally uncritically, but partly, I suppose, and.
I should ask you the same question.
Sorry, you're wandering off onto me.
No. It's appropriate because I have to do it. I asked you to define yourself sociologically, and I'm wondering whether you could do the same in terms of your background, where you come from.
Well, my mother was a sort of minor Scottish aristocrat, rather keen on her connections with the Duke of Athol, that sort of thing, called Murray, and they were, in the end, they were minor county, quite poor, and. There were five daughters, and none of them went to school like girls did in the 1880s, 1890s. So she was formally uneducated, but in fact very artistic, and managed to sort of train herself as an artist. And she was extremely clever at embroidery and all sorts of artistic activities. My father came from a very different background. Well, his father was in Jardine Matheson, a Chinese.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And they were reasonably, they were quite well off, whereas my mother's family wasn't. They never had any money, it was gone. They were reasonably, he wasn't very rich, my father, but my grandfather was quite well off. Well, stop me if I'm going on a few relevances. My father was a clever boy, and went to Harrow and got scholarships, and went to New College, and became a prize fellow at New College, where he didn't teach or anything. And then he went to the bar in about 1870, must have gone to the bar, the early 90s, I suppose. Chancery Bar. See, I'm connected with the Chancery Bar.
New College, too.
Yeah.
And marrying my father, I suppose. And he wasn't terribly successful at the bar, I think. He made a very unfortunate first marriage, which was a complete disaster. And they didn't speak for 10 years. And sort of he finally married my mother in 1910, 1911. And he was going to stay at the bar, but in the war he went into the Home Office. He tried to join up, but nobody was rejected. He went into the Home Office as a legal advisor, and was obviously very well thought of, and they asked him to stay at the end of the war. But in fact he became the legal advisor to the British delegation to the Reparations Commission in Paris. So we all moved to Paris in 1920, we were by then four children. Well, five really. And he was an intellectual, very clever, very sharp, wasn't he?
Mm. Didn't good classical scholar.
And very well read and on a wide field, Margaret's Library.
How long were you in Paris?
Well, the family were there for 10 years, but the last 2 years I was sent to a boarding school in England because he knew that Operation Solutions would end ultimately, and he thought we'd better be rooted in some sort of school in England.
And then when he came back, he settled in Oxford?
In Oxford, yes. But when I was at school in England, we still went, of course, to Paris or abroad for holidays, except we always had this Cornish house. So we were quite well off, and my father was very happy in this job. It was very liberating. He went to Geneva a lot, and The Hague, and I was terribly interested in his work.
He's an international lawyer.
Yes, he became an international lawyer, sometimes a combination of the bar plus the Home Office, because he was on England in the Home Office. And he wrote a number of books and articles, and he was very keen on the League, and he was really one of the original sort of creators of the League. So I was very much involved with all this. And
so your maiden name was?
Fisher Williams, well, Williams really. He was called John Fisher Williams. And I was brought up to think that war was just the most awful thing there was. And I was taken to the war areas in France and shown the men engaged in cemeteries. But he wasn't a pacifist, but he believed that law should, international disputes should be settled by law. Mm-hmm. That was a great thing. He was only 60 in 1930 when the Reparations Commission packed in. And so they had to move back to England. And he was offered various jobs, but he was rather haughty. He turned them down, unfortunately. He was a great friend of Claude Schuster, who was the permanent secretary, the Lord Chancellor, who had met the package. And he was offered county courtship and various other things. But he somehow refused all these and built a house in Oxford and thought he'd have lots of friends there and would have an interesting life. But it didn't turn out quite like that because he'd lost his salary. And he had some private income. Then there was the world crash, and he had his five daughters, and they were all educated privately in the university. And then international affairs began going really wrong, so he became incredibly gloomy, understandably, throughout the 30s, which slightly coloured my life too, because I was very devoted to. I thought, is any of this relevant?
No. I mean, there are very few people who are as important to my biographical subject as the two of you, so the more I know about you, the better, really.
Well, I don't know, some of this is not perfect. I don't think I was a wife, was it? I said, I didn't meet my father.
But when did you join the Communist Party?
Summer of 1935. Mm-hmm. I'd just come down from Oxford, and, my political career, I was a keen liberal. At school, I stood as a liberal candidate. The election of 1959, meeting concurrent employment. I didn't exactly get the term by the members of the school, but the fascists did less well than me. And then I moved to the left in the early 30s and abandoned my father's liberalism, but didn't really dare tell him because he was a little upset, I think. He didn't much like socialism, I confess. But when I was at Oxford, I was a member of the Liberal Party at Oxford, to be fair. First year or so, and then I almost became Labour. But I was very much wrapped up in the League of Nations Union. I worked for that a lot and used to go around giving lectures about the League of Nations. Then I went to a friend of mine at Somerville said, we're running a camp for unemployed people, unemployed miners from Wales and people from the East End of London. And we had running a camp near Oxford. Would you like to come? Well, in fact, it was run more or less by the NUWM, which is communist dominated, which I didn't really know at the time. I was fairly naive about the communists, I think. And not that I really regret it. So I thought, well, it would be interesting. I was very much more concerned with domestic things than Isaiah ever was. Herbert and people like Isaiah, I think, only really got interested in politics with the international crisis. They got very politicised in the 30s, but it was all international affairs. Yes. Whereas I was always upset about poverty and felt terrible guilt about being reasonably well off. So I went to this camp, and I was in a very emotional state. I'd just done schools and was longing to get to do well. and I immediately fell in love with an unemployed milkman and broke all the rules and went to sleep in his tent and in my tent. It was all very romantic. And there were these unemployed miners and we used to sing songs. And there were people there like Philip Toynbee and Wendy Charles and quite a lot of communist undergraduates who obviously hoped to get me in. And it wasn't very difficult. I suddenly saw that this was great because you were wanted and it was a closely knit organisation. And guilt then could go because you were part of the working, well, not exactly part of the working classes, but on their side. So you didn't feel this worry that you were privileged and it was always good in your eyes. So I joined up fairly easily, really.
I want to know, I want to connect your stories together. When do you meet him? You meet him in Cornwall at the schools in
Easter of 36.
Easter of 36. And this is summer of 35 that
we're
talking
about.
Yes,
so I was a communist then and about to go into civil service if I got in, which I hadn't done the exam yet. And I was going to be a secret communist in the civil service, not a Russian spy, I'm hasten to say. That never came up. But I was terribly naive, as you can well imagine, and very ingenuous about it all. But I somehow thought that I would somehow probably help the Communist Party in some way. And they, well, originally when I joined the Communist Party, I said, oh, well, I won't go into civil service, it seemed to me. I couldn't be a communist in civil service. I wanted to do sort of social work or something. You know. But they said, no, fine, wonderful, you can go in and you'll be useful to us. But I still didn't really understand what they were at, because when I was interviewed by the civil service commissioners, I said I wanted to go into the Ministry of Labour because I thought you could help employment or something. And they said, the Communist Party said, no, the civil service commissioners said, no, it's a rather inferior